Oh, do you recall by any chance of over on the Minum, the splash dam that was up there when that logging was done down through there?
No.
The mill was down there in Minum, you know, where the
Just heard,
Minum
heard a few brief stories. Yeah. I've never known anybody that was really involved in that. There again, LaRose and Dick Hibbard might have some insight. Dick had an interest in Red's Horse Ranch years ago. Mm-hmm. And of course, now the splash dam, when they logged that, I don't know. I heard stories. They had a logging camp down at the Land Ranch or thereabouts. And Louis Hale ran a pack train. I serviced that out of Minum. Boy, those things are tough to come by. No, I not much help on that, but that might be a lead.
Yeah, I
was going to ask you a question. There's a law on the books, apparently a legislative law, that's been pretty dormant for years, but twice it's focused, came into focus, and that's the navigability determination. Have you run into any conversation?
No, I haven't. I've seen a little bit in the paper, you know, talking about, yeah, but I've never anything in depth or extent.
First time it showed up, I did a little work on some people were still alive that were involved in Mount Emily Lumber Company and how they brought the logs down and the log floats and splash dams up tail end of Tony's meadow and that kind of thing. I just wondered if you'd had any conversation about
it. No, the only thing, of course, that quit about 1906 when they put the railroad in.
Yeah.
So they ran the logs up to that time.
Yeah, well, that's the reason the railroad went in, because the rest of it was a mess. Yeah.
But they had that, you know, the river runs there, and that was before Mount Emily. That was the Grand Ronde Lumber Company, of course, is doing that. And then 1906 was when the railroad started. And then Mount Emily, it was 1924 when they actually started cutting their first log.
Yeah.
So they bought out the land of the Grand Ronde and, you know, kind of extended the railroad.
Yeah.
Farther up the
creek. What about the Perry Mill?
Well, that was the Grand Ronde Lumber Company. See, it's originally...
Oh, the Perry Mill was?
Yeah.
No, yeah, I just run across the note on that, and they moved that mill to Pondosa.
Right, yeah, in 1926 they shut it down.
Yeah, see, right.
And moved to Pondosa. But that, you know, people that owned that took that over to Pondosa, but then Mount Emily bought out their land holdings, the railroad and the land up above, you know, up the Grand Ronde, and then they... kind of supplanting them, you might say.
See, what was the name of the other big mill?
Well, Palmer.
Bowman Hicks.
Well, it was Palmer before Bowman Hicks.
Oh, it was.
Yeah, Palmer started in 1907 is when they went over to Palmer Junction and logged all that off for about 7 years and hauled that to LeGrand. And then Bowman Hicks, well, then they went to Smith Mountain when they logged that off. They took Smith Mountain. So I think it's about 1921, somewhere in there, Bowman Hicks bought them out, and that was the mill at the old fairgrounds, where the fairgrounds is now.
I barely remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was one thing I never got much on Bowman Hicks of what that progression was, but evidently they bought the Palmer holdings, and then, of course, they logged out of Wallowa, but they had the mill here in Wallowa.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they've been cutting trees for a long time.
Oh, as soon as the first settlers here, I mean, they started sawmills, because Fox Hill, or George Fox, right there at Oradell, right there on the west side of the Grand, that was one of the first mills in 80, or 63. And then the Union, there's a mill there, and then 6 miles up Cabin Creek is another one here in 63. And we went from there to Somerville and over Indian Valley, so I mean, there's... But they're taking a lot of volume off. I got some pictures the other day that was really, you know, kind of like never knew up on Mount Harris, where they had a heck of a deck up there, and the school carts are hauling. One picture shows horses pulling this wagon that was on, you know, had the log skid with a, we call it spool cars, where like a little railroad car with 8,000 feet on it with a horse drawn.
Where's that set
right
up?
Right up on top of Mount Emily. It's 1900.
Or Harris?
Or Harris, I'm sorry. No, Mount Harris. It's 1900.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, I know. I'll bet that was back in when I was a kid and we fished up there. The only site that I ever saw, a former site, there was two, one down on the old Indian Creek campground, right on Indian Creek, and one down the road north, it was called Paddy Meadows, and I bet that's the one you're talking about.
Might be. It's, you know, from the pictures, you couldn't really tell location, just says Mount Harris, and so it's a toughie.
But as far as up in the timber proper, I don't recall ever seeing or hearing anything about it. But Paddy Meadows did have an old mill at one time. And then there was a mill down on, the old Traversal ground, right down on Indian Creek.
When you start looking at the old records, though, I mean, there were so many mills around here.
Oh, yeah, everybody had them.
Well, they would, you know, cut out and then move and,
or pick them up and go.
Or go broke and somebody else would, you know, pick up the equipment.
There was a mill on the north end right around, right straight to you. You take the old road and go around. Well, I was of high school age, I guess, when that was operating. I don't even know who operated it. But there was a name around that still owns property here. L.C. Smith, does that ring a bell?
I heard the name.
They owned a lot of timber property. They were a family that apparently had a few dollars in the Depression. And they were buying, bought a lot of land. A lot of timber land for buck an acre or whatever, you know. That's how.
Fairly profitable to hang out there long time.
Well, of course they were selling, but they couldn't help it.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah.
We'd missed our fortune that we weren't buying timber when we could have.
Right. Crystal ball, if we had that.
Oh, yeah. Hindsight.
But, you know, there's a looked like an old wagon road off Mount Harris. I don't know if, like, right up on top, if they cut that and hauled lumber down there, or just what that was, but it would have had been around the turn of the century.
Goes back east off the top of Mount Harris?
Well, I thought it came off this end here.
Oh.
Old wagon road, you know.
Oh, well, I think the only road I've ever known, we call it Rattlesnake Gap.
Yeah.
If you look out the window here, Jerry, you know where it's at. It goes right up as the Slotchways, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, it goes up through a gap on the north, and there's a rock cut up there.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know if they ever haul lumber off of there.
Well, it's a steep grade. Yeah, that's what I remember.
Well, it's the big boulders. My dad, every fall, when we lived down here east of Embler, he'd take the hay rack off the old steel wheel hay rack, and he had brake chocks in it, and he'd cut out the brake blocks out of apple wood, and the way they worked, they were a cast block, and then you just shaped your wood in a V and slipped them in there, and he'd build those out of apple wood. They'd make one or two trips up there, see, and then they had a lever that had quite a lot of leverage, and you'd cut a good green stout pole, about 3-inch pole, and taper that and stick in that. And then you'd tie a double block pulley that would take a 1/2-inch rope or so. And you had a double block on it. And that was your brake, see? Well, this friend, that was the old McGoldrick ground. And they were neighbors of Dad's. And every fall we'd go up there and he'd cut wood. And we'd cross-haul it with the team onto the bunks of the wagon. And or we'd haul down bridge timber, because we had a private wood bridge across the Grand Round down at the place. So we hauled two things. And I tell you, my dad, I don't know how he lived through it. We had an old team, and we'd come down through those rock slides. He's standing up on top of the load. He's hanging onto the team this way, hanging on the brake that way, and if something broke, I mean, he would have been gone. But the the wagon just literally just sort of wallowed its way down through the rocks, and the britching on the team was tight all the time. They kept their feet. I don't know how. I remember that road. And as far as I know, that's the only road down through there. Now, a little later on, right at the top end of the meadow, they cut down through land that used to belong to Harvey Ruckman. Well, it still belongs to his daughter, Mary Bennett. And it come down at the Noyes property down here over the hill. But that got, when they got trucks to log with, they logged some stuff out of there, and gosh, the ruts were belly deep, you know. So it didn't hold up very well. But there was a lot of logs later on came out that way. But where that mill would have been in those days, I don't know.
Just had them scattered all over. So there's nothing there in the picture that you could decide, you know, decide except there's heavily timbered around it. It's just a matter of knowing, or if they, I'm just assuming they cut them up in the forest and then brought the lumber out, because that's the way a lot of them did, but it's hard to tell. But just had in there 1900, so it's, would have been the early days.
There's some things that went on up there. I was hunting with my dad, most likely 18, 20 years old, and we went up here deer hunting. And I circled up back sort of on the northeast, and it was really timber. There was no logging currently at that time up there at all, brushing. And I came up on a rocky ridge, just sort of opened up on a little rocky point, and lo and behold, there's an old shack up there and a fruit tree. Now, somebody lived there, lived there, and I, for several years, I asked around people that might be knew what that was. Never did find out.
Well, when I went through that survey of 1863, Bill, they show a road access around Mount Harris that way in 1863, if you can believe that one.
Holy cats.
Which I can't. It's hard to imagine why they would have been up in there at that period in time.
They were still pioneering.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, there's all this other area that was easier going.
But what were they? They were looking for something.
A place to live.
Look over the hill. Maybe there's a valley there.
Up there. But that's a tough way to go.
Did it show? Did they come on down Indian Creek then?
It showed an access road around that. Just a wagon road.
That most likely hit Indian Creek and went on down into Indian Valley.
Yeah. But I mean, that's a tough one. Of all the routes and places you could go, that's a rugged one to get to, because that's pretty good elevation.
Jerry, a question of you. As you put this together, and I don't know how far you've been, but have you drawn any conclusions what we in the uplands, how we've affected the fish migration, or have we?
Well, I think, this whole life cycle, of the fish, the salmon or steelhead like there, goes from the ocean
Sure.
There's no question about that.
It's a tie-in. They got to get up here to.
Well, first of all, you got to have the ocean. It's what's happening out there, as far as fishing and food, because that's their life cycle. What happened to the habitat in the ocean, and then of course, up the river itself, you've got
the corridor.
You got
the Columbia. Yeah,
but way back, when you start looking at numbers that were caught before the turn of the century, they had the cannery down there, they had the fish wheels, they had the ditmats, and so there was a tremendous volume of just sheer numbers that were taken out before they ever got to the headwaters. And talking to some of the people up here that can remember, it just didn't seem like it was a crash for numbers, but just gradual from in the Catherine Creek there particularly. I haven't found too much in the Grand Ronde as much as I have with Catherine Creek, where they had the large numbers, in the 20s and 30s, it started decreasing, but I can remember clear up into the 60s, right around the early 60s, you still had a lot of fish in there.
Oh, yes.
Once dams came in, then it seemed like, that really crashed, but like you said, that 1941 survey report, they're talking there about what was happening to the habitat, where all this was sidecast, in other words, the spawning beds, where you either had barriers there where they couldn't get up in there, or destroying, you know, the beds and the damage, you know, to the creeks. So all that is inherent in being a detriment, you know, to the runs, but probably not where that was, it seemed like, you know, the major factor, because you still had the runs coming out. Even though you had all this logging going on for decades and decades and decades, you had the heavy, you know, overgrazing back up through that Starkey country, where they're bringing the herds of sheep through there, the cattle through there, and horses, you know, like there. So that a lot of soil, and plus up the Grand Ronde, they were taking in hydraulic mining. And so
I think up Carson Mine?
Yeah, you know, Carson Mine. Yeah. A million and a half yards of soil went down that creek. Well, you know, you talk about siltation. And then that was the dredging. I always thought was the turn of the century, but it was 39 when they were dredging that thing. And then in the 50s, they hit it again, and in the 80s, they hit it again.
At Carson?
Yeah, Carson.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so there, and then they went back in, I guess, what, 96, I think, to rehabilitate that, but it didn't really work, because what they're doing, they're sidecasting that into the edge.
Sure.
And then, of course, you know, when you
well, we,
snows and that, it was dumping it in the creek.
I know we approved some funding, forgot who the people were, that was going to rehabilitate that
project, that was
96,
yeah,
or
96,
actually 95.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they did the work in 96. But I didn't know they had done work up there in the 80s.
Yeah, it was around 82 when they had the shovels in there.
When we had $400 gold or...
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, or more.
Or more.
Because Rainbow Mine, and there's some others up there. Did they... Rainbow ever open up again?
Not that I know of, or nothing significant.
And there was one up...
Yeah. Well, you had the Indiana Mine and the Aurora...
Indiana Mine's down on the river.
Yeah.
I think the Rainbow was up on the hill to the east.
Yeah. And then the Arella or something like that.
Yeah, they were active, pretty active along that period. But I didn't know Carson Mine ever did.
But the, you know, the Carson and that Tanner Gulch, I mean, that's the one that was dumping everything
into
the creek. Like there were Indiana Mine, I think, was all hard rock.
Pretty much.
So it wasn't near, except for maybe leaching out of there, you know, into the creek. You
didn't washed away the mountainside up there.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a project. When I visited that, we were hunting elk up there. Early 70s, maybe earlier than that. I don't know, but the buildings were still up. They were still in pretty good shape. And the doors on the old saloon still worked. You walked up the stairs. You could still walk up the steps into the porch on the old saloon. And the wood, as I recall, was weathered, but it wasn't rotten. Then we walked out to where the pipe came in from the upper ground, how they was getting the water down there to hydro.
That's the Camp Carson you're talking
about. Yeah, Camp Carson, right, up on top of the hill.
Right.
And what was that, an 18, 20-inch plank pipe?
Yeah, I think so.
Wrapped, steel wrap. That they brought that in clear from the, whatever the level was up there, and tapped the water source of the Grand Round. And it was quite a project. But I didn't know they'd ever open that up again.
Yeah, they dredged the creek bottom. That was in 1939, the Aurora Plata outfit that came in and brought a, it wasn't like the old time dredge there at Sumter, it was shovel type, but dredged all that. It's about 2 mile stretch down through there, and that was the bottom land. And then it, you know, that went out of business, and then as I think 57 or someplace in there in the 50s, they did a little bit of work, and then again they hit it again in 82, I think it was, on there. And then of course you have the try to rehabilitate it there in 96.
Yeah. Well, that's the watershed health money that went into that.
Well, up there at the geology department there in Baker, they said they had some problems with how effective that was.
Yeah. Well, I've never heard whether it's effective or not, you know. Certainly some of these things maybe aren't effective.
Yeah.
We spent a lot of money on wire. fencing.
Yeah.
Some of it was put too close to some creeks, wadded up in the ball.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I guess you gotta do something.
Well, that's part of the history, I think, is to look and monitor to learn from, you know, if it was not done right or senselessly, is to, you know, recognize that and say, hey, don't repeat it. Just don't go back and just keep doing it just for the sake of doing something.
A tremendous amount of, to me, erratic concepts, erratic pressures for quick fixes. This didn't get this way overnight, and it won't healed overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, we have to take an overall view and maintain some economies.
Mm-hmm.
I can't fix things on my ranch if I don't make some money.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
You know, and if we dry up our economies.
Mm-hmm.
But I've sort of taken a lot of look and listen. And what I have concluded, in my own opinion, is that yes, we need to do the very best job we can.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be aware. This TMDAL study is just starting. In fact, go to my first meeting as an Ag Committee Monday. I have no idea where that's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of understand it, but just sort of. But that's going to tell us some things, what's going in the river. So we take a look at that. In the meantime, we got to devise some plans that we still stay on the land, we still produce.
Mm-hmm.
And how we get there is going to be the difficult part. And the longer I listen to these things and listen to different people, I told some watershed health people one time, I says, you know, I see no justification that would dictate to our area, timber, cattle, ranching. Major changes over what we do in a conservative, good managed practice. And we have those on the books. Some, we haven't been doing it in all the cases. But we're gaining.
Mm-hmm.
We're, Measure 38, for example, is most likely one of the most awareness things that could happen to the cattle industry. They got their attention.
Mm-hmm.
Bad bill, but it got people's attention, you see.
Well, unfortunately, this is what it takes. You know, the randomism of the thing is what it takes, which is very unfortunate, because then it goes to extreme.
Yeah.
And just like here, talking about shutting the whole forest down, for instance. You know, hey, we don't want to do anything. Well, that's not the answer either, because of sitting back and not doing anything.
Oh, I don't believe so.
Well, it's not going to stay that way.
Mm-mm.
When you look at the insect problems and, you know, the fire problems and like that, hopefully man, with intelligence and technology, can aid Mother Nature in doing a better job. But that hasn't been the case, unfortunately.
No.
But it is possible there. But you got to be able to weigh all the factors to do it.
I really think that the pendulum will turn around, that we do have to have management.
Oh, it is.
See, we've gone through this. We've failed. We haven't done anything. Give it back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let nature
take its course.
Well,
nature does take its course.
Let me ask you something.
Yeah.
Have you followed the Eastside Ecosystem Plan very closely?
Not really closely. I think so many of these plans now, I may be talking out of line on that one, Bill, but you know, when you start doing these plans, there's this of do everything in the worst way, do nothing on the other extreme, and so it always goes right down the middle without you paying any common sense to actually what are conditions out on the ground, and realizing that like this whole Grand Island watershed is so complex. You can't say, and this is what you see in the papers, and I mean, it's gone clear in Washington, D.C., that when the pioneers first came here, all this was open ponderosa pine you could drive your wagons through that was all grass covered.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the biggest fallacy of anything that you can imagine, if you even go back to the old journals, where when the first pioneers came here, they had to shut down and stop because they had to cut their way through that forest to get the wagons through. And that's right there, you know, documentation. Time after time after time, but for the political agenda, they don't want to see that or recognize it or pay attention to it, see?
Yeah.
That was not the way the forest was. And the other thing is, when you go on the Oregon Trail, it's just a small route that you're going through, and I defy anybody, the best scientists in the world, to stand there on that Oregon Trail and tell me what's back in Indian Creek, what's back up Sheep Creek, and there's no way in the world you can do that.
No, can't do it. We were just up chukar hunting after Christmas on Saturday and went up toward Lookout Mountain. Why didn't we ever have